Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Brent Bowlby, stepping in as your guest host today. And I'm truly honored to sit down with the man who's usually guiding us at Fair Parenting UK. Today, he's our guest, and we're driving into his incredible, heart-wrenching journey as a dad caught in a nightmare of abuse and legal battles. I've been fighting my own seven-year struggle in the US courts, and he's been at it in the UK for nearly a decade. We've got some time to unpack his story, compare our fights, and shine a light on a system that's let down so many. At Fair Parenting UK, it means the world to have you here. How are you holding up? How does it feel to share this with us today?
Thanks very much for a wonderful intro. It's a bit strange. Quite often I talk to the guests before and after recording, and I delve into my story then. I've only had one episode so far on my story, which was episode 28. So I think this is probably overdue because a lot's happened. And I feel honored that you've agreed to do this.
Well, I appreciate that. I just, again, thank you for letting us in. You know, I can already feel the strengths that it takes to keep going. I've been following your updates on X, including that pinned post about the last few months. And I know your listeners, many facing their own battles, will find so much in what you share. Let's start with this care and honesty, because we're here to listen and stand with you. So with that, you've called yourself a regular guy who's endured 5 years of abuse from your co-parent in the UK. Can you take us back to when that started? What did abuse look like, and how did it begin to affect you and your child?
Really, it started the night of the birth. It's hard to go back. We're talking about 6.5 years now. My co-parent said the night of the birth, that she'd never held a baby before. And I think she was about 38 at that time. And it just struck me as being, you know, a bit unusual. But we never really, just never got around to discussing things like that. So that seemed a bit odd. But she sort of became a little bit critical of me on that night, But that's fine, because you just assume that, you know, she's bound to be overprotective. And that's fine. You make allowances for it. But things never really went back to how they were before the birth. Before the birth, we were very, very amicable and on the same page with parenting issues. And it was just very a good match. But it all changed the day of the birth. Progressively after that, things became controlling and criticizing. Later, some years later, we had a trial, and she was found to have gaslit me. And at the beginning of the case, that's very much what was happening, undermining and gaslighting. Again, I'm a very reasonable person. You try to make a lot of, I don't like to argue at all. So you try to make a lot of allowances, and rightly so for somebody who's just given birth. And, obviously there's a long recovery period. It was a cesarean. But things just deteriorated. For example, it just little things to begin with. We were out walking the baby, and when we got back, she had said that I'd pushed the pram in front of a car, and there had been no car. I just was floored by that. I couldn't understand what was happening there. But you just think, oh, I don't know, and just move on. Then things became more and more controlling. It became more difficult to see my baby. And then at 2 months old, I was stopped from seeing my baby. And things had deteriorated all the while. My co-parent had emailed me the day before stopping me seeing the child, saying that the baby was going to bed in three layers of clothing because she was so cold and the mother couldn't afford to put the heating on. And I was paying a very high level of maintenance at that stage. So I couldn't understand it. And I was worried. So I said, look, I'll come round. And she said, no, don't. But I was concerned. You know, I had no experience of this type of behavior before. And I was first-time dad as well, worried about a two-month-old baby. So I did knock on the door. And she said, oh, I'm not letting you in. And I'd never had experience of anything like this. And, but I drove away and, with tears in my eyes, not knowing if the baby was okay. And, I went to see a solicitor the next day, and, it was not until 4.5 months later, even with the court helping, it was not until 4.5 months later that I actually saw my child again. Just along that journey, you know, once I'd gone to the court, you know, false allegations began. You know, it's a well-trodden path that a lot of us will know. And each phase of this, I'd never experienced anything like it. I'd never been accused of anything. I'd never had false accusations or it just seemed so odd to me. I didn't really know how to cope with it. And I think this is a problem with the legal system, is they don't tell you how to cope with it. You know, I think everyone who's beginning this journey, it's very, very difficult and expensive and frightening and time consuming. And nobody really prepares you for it. These lawyers must have seen a million mums and dads come into their office for the first time, and they don't prepare them. They just basically open the gates of hell and in you walk. So anyway, sorry for the sprawling answer, but that's it.
No, I think that's great. I mean, you explained your story a little bit there. I'm going to dive in and maybe get a little bit deeper. I believe that, you know, you've been to court so many times or a number of times. And I believe that you said, you know, you felt like you didn't have any protection that came for you or your child. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, as I say, we had a 4-day trial they found me innocent of all charges, and they found my co-parent to have done, was it 4 of the 5 charges? And it was fairly, well, it was overwhelming.
So that must have been crushing. I mean, here you've got your ex who is already found to have created problems in the relationship affecting you and your relationship with your baby. And you go to court and you're found not guilty. What was it like to hear those rulings? But, you know, I imagine you must have still felt pretty alone.
Yes. It was, I'd never been in a trial before. I was cross-examined for over 6 hours over the 4 days. It was very, very nerve-wracking. Also, it spanned days. So on the second day, I was very tired because I didn't sleep very well. It was a very traumatic, and the preparation as well. You have to write, you know, your court documents, get the bundles together. Again, it's things that most people don't have to go through, thank God. But even the trial was 3 years into the case. So we'd had 3 years of allegations, broken, many, many broken court orders. My daughter had been taken 3 hours away. At that stage, moved or abducted 3 hours away without my permission or the court permission. You would think that would be illegal in England, but no, it's not. And so it's just horrendous, yeah, at that stage. And to have the verdict that we had was a relief. And I thought that things would get better, but they got worse. There was no protection from the court. They knew I was being abused and was vulnerable, and my child was, because she was being alienated. But they did nothing. And it's, you know, I didn't have knowledge of the system at that stage, so I just expected that things would get better. But, you know, obviously from speaking to other people and my own case, you realize that that's just, you know, par for the course, and that this is the way these cases work.
Well, you know, it certainly seems like lawyers get together and they follow pretty much the same rule book, it seems. So I would say they probably are educated in how to, you know, prevent a parent from seeing a child by using techniques. I know in the States we have techniques, you know, that lawyers use. There's even euphemisms like the silver bullet technique. And it's just a way that lawyers will abuse the court system to end up with whatever they're trying to get in terms of a win or an award. But, you know, it seems to me like, you know, what's been going on with you is somewhat similar. I know that you've pinned a post on your ex account, and you've said you've been like most people who go through these things with the family courts, that you've been financially ruined,
yeah,
even losing your family house to the system. And now, just so you know, I speak to men every day. This doesn't happen to just, you know, occasionally. This happens in the majority of the cases. And even I can say that, you know, I went through something very similar. Unfortunately, men seems to take the brunt of these major losses, not only, you know, breaking up of a family, not seeing their children, but oftentimes are forced out of the family home. So I don't know, you know, how did the courts let that happen? And, you know, what was the moment you realized no one was going to step in and help you out?
That's a difficult one, because I had at the beginning of back in 2018, you know, a few people, you know, online and in life, real life, sort of said, you know, how corrupt and bad the system was. But I don't like to think that way, and I like to believe in, you know, truth and fairness, and I, you know, and, you know, justice, laughably. So I kept for a long, long, long time. I kept believing that this would turn around. I just don't. And in one of the earlier episodes, I forget which one it was, I say a few times that I don't want to believe that the system's like this. Now I do. Yeah, I've had my eyes open. I've been naive for too long. What moment did I realize that it wasn't going to? So, I mean, right before the trial, a few weeks before the trial, we had 112 pages of police evidence where my co-parent had called them 17 times alleging abuse. Now, the police make very clear that I did nothing wrong. And there's many occasions where they say, well, we sat them parent down, the mother, and we explained that he's done nothing wrong and she now accepts this, and only for her to call them again in a week or two, and it just seemed like a loop. I mean, in England we have a charge wasting police time, but that never kicked in. I mean, the amount of public money that's been wasted in this case is incredible. I hoped when I saw the police report that things would turn around. After the trial, I thought things would turn around. The mother then appealed, and we had a written rejection from the High Court. She then asked for a verbal chance to appeal, and they gave that, and they then said, we'll grant you a hearing. And she raised 7 grounds to appeal the findings against her, and the judge threw out 6 of them. So the judge basically said, she'd been found to have coercively controlled me, and the judge said, I'll let you appeal that. It was on a technicality, but she said, I'll let you appeal that one. She didn't say, you haven't coercively controlled me. She just said, I'll let you appeal it. The other 6, the judge kicked out as baseless. So the all but one of the findings of abuse stand to this day. Even at that stage, I kind of thought, well, you know, it's so one-sided. You know, after all these years, I hadn't been found to have done anything wrong. And the abuse had been pretty incredible at this stage. And you still keep hoping, you know, this was 4 years in. I just really don't know at what point. We had a new judge, and he was pretty bad, to be honest. And we had a court advisor. I mean, this is now the beginning of 2023, so you're nearly 4.5 years in at this point. And her last words to me were, "We like to give 50-50. But she said, I'm going to go now to talk to the child solicitor. And the result of that meeting was she came back and said, you get 2 days a fortnight. So I don't know what that child solicitor said or why. But over the previous months, I realized that there were hands on the wheel of the case that weren't in the courtroom. Which has made me realise that the moment I started losing faith. I've covered this in the episode I did with Dr. Marnie Foderaro. She was fantastic. I really recommend everyone listen to that episode. I described this very well in that episode. Now, we had the findings in the court, and she was found to have abused me. At that stage, we had to put forward our recommendations for psychologist and psychiatrist, which I did and the mother did. I put forward, the mother had been found to have tried to alienate the child. So I put forward an expert on alienation cases. The child solicitor, the mother's barrister, and the court advisor, the CAFCAS officer, all launched in, you know, they all intervened to stop my choice of psychiatrist, and they all recommended, my choice is a national figure, she does cases all over the country, they recommended a local psychologist who wasn't an expert in alienation, but they all seemed very keen for her to do this, the psychologist, and they pushed the judge very hard. They made calls in the background very quickly to another person to push, you know, to convince this judge in a short space of time that we had to use this local psychologist. They should have been neutral. The mother's barrister, okay, but the child solicitor and the CAFCAS officer should have been neutral. I don't know why they had any preference, but they all work in the locality of this psychologist. They all know each other. They all, you know, if I can put it this way, they all do business with each other. And it struck me as being very strange. The judge went with their decision, and the subsequent psychologist report did not mention alienation once, despite them assuring the judge that she could evaluate the alienation. And the psychologist recommended that I only have 2 days a fortnight. She did not refer to the court judgment at all, the abuse. And she said some things about me and the way I had behaved. And sometime later, over a year later, I had to cross-examine the psychologist in the final hearing because I'd run out of money. I was on my own at this stage. And I sort of addressed that. And I said, you said a couple of negative things about me. Could I just ask you to give an example of what I said that made you think that? And she couldn't. And I sort of said, well, what about this? Could you give me an example? And she couldn't. There were no examples given. And the judge intervened and he said, okay, we understand your point. And later the judge referred to the psychologist. Again, somebody, he said the psychologist is well known to the court. And I thought to myself at that stage, I thought, well, what does that even mean, well known to the court? Does that mean that you're just going to take blindly what she says? Because I asked her for examples and she couldn't give any. In my view, she made stuff up. But the judge was like, well, she's well known to the court. I mean, we have a famous serial killer in England called Harold Shipman, who killed several hundred of his patients. Now, he was well known to the hospital. What does that prove? It just seemed crazy. It didn't seem to stack up with the evidence. And really, it was the way the child solicitor and the CAFCAS officer steered the judge to use in their choice of psychologist and the subsequent report that was so flawed. It was at that point that I realized that this was corrupt and it had nothing to do with what went on in the courtroom. There were hands on the wheel outside of the court. And that's when I think I realized that the system was broken.
Wow. I'll tell you that's quite a story. And yet if I didn't acknowledge that I had a very similar experience.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people who don't have any experience going through the family court system, whether it's in the UK or here in the US, you end up on the other side of that if you're lucky enough to get to the other side, completely broken most of the time. And there really isn't any sense of, you know, right and wrong, because if there was, you know, the outcomes, I believe, would be far different. So, for example, when you were talking about the officers of the court or your ex's attorney or was recommending that you use a particular psychologist, that is really common.
Yeah.
And what I found is that when you are a lawyer and you have, you know, in the US, they call them super lawyers. It's not hard to become a super lawyer. But they're the ones that recommend these professionals, be it the psychiatric evaluation and the person who will do that from who is a psychologist to a parental consultant or evaluator, rather, or, to do an evaluation. And so they run in all the same circles. And let's put it this way, one feeds off the other. Yeah. In the U.S., it's a $50 billion family court boondoggle. $50 billion is spent annually in family court fighting. And what I could tell you is that when the court ordered me to get a psychiatric evaluation, the opposition, the other side, rejected it and brought in a state professional to try to debunk my psychiatric evaluation because it didn't follow the wrong narrative, the negative narrative that they wanted it to follow. So the judge made me go for a much more in-depth psychiatric evaluation, and it really didn't show any other, you know, difference, except that this was just something that the other side kept influencing the court to do. Just, you know, it's like, try to get anything that will stick on them, just anything.
Yeah.
It didn't work, but you know, I think that you know, you've had other issues beyond just what's happened in court.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit? I think you mentioned in a write-up about a violent thug that, you know, entered your life and or has been harassing you. And this person is associated with your co-parent, your ex, and who's already threatened you. And can you maybe share a little bit about that? Because I know that that's an interesting twist in your story. Because between the last time you were in court until now, you know, a number of things have happened. Can you give us a little bit of an update on, you know, that period of time in between?
It's in between, sorry, when? The final hearing?
The final hearing and then finding yourself in a precarious position and having to essentially go on the run of fifth, that's the correct term, to some very serious threats. Is that accurate to say that, or am I overstating that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple of overseas holidays with my child. On the third one, due to fear and worries, I didn't return to the UK. I voiced the fears to the co-parent, and basically things were just getting worse and worse and worse. And as I say, there was no protection. And I was extremely worried about returning. And I said, look, can we go to mediation? I'd like to feel safe, and I'd like some safeguards if we can mediate them. Now, this we did. We spent a few weeks. We worked with a company called Reunite, which I think are the sort of leaders. They do cases in America and worldwide, in fact, but they're UK based. And we worked for weeks with them, and we got mediated an agreement. It never got signed officially because I'll go back a little bit. When we had the just a few days before the first mediation session in October 23, I found that there was an ex parte hearing in which my bank accounts and my house were frozen. And I just couldn't really believe that, because we'd had sort of amicable exchanges and productive, and I was in fear of my co-parent. And so the idea that we were just about to go into mediation, we'd had some initial discussions and agreed everything beforehand. In fact, my co-parent was saying, let's not even go to mediation. Let's just go to the court with what we've discussed. And I said, well, I'd like to go just to see, you know, they're professionals. Let's just see what they think and what they like. And then to find out that she secretly, behind my back, frozen my bank accounts. Bearing in mind, I was a parent and child abroad. She didn't know whether we had accommodation or food or anything. It's sent my fear off the charts. I mean, this is somebody, at this point I was saying, I'm really frightened. And she was doing things that made me more frightened. But I said, look, okay, let's carry on with mediation. I was really, I mean, I'm always really constructive and I just want peace. So I carried on. And over the weeks, a few weeks, we got the agreement. But then she wouldn't lift the sanctions even when we'd reached agreement. And that was why it never got signed. But we then got to, I think it was January 24. It might have been February 24. And I said to the judge, I'd been cut off from legal help because my bank accounts were frozen. So I had no legal advice to know whether this agreement that we'd made would hold legally, or, you know, I was just on my own, facing some very experienced barristers. So I said to the High Court judge, I said, you know, I got nobody else to ask. I said, would this deal hold if we got it, the mediators, to draw it up and presented it to you? And she said, if it is a consent order, then likely it's going to hold. And I felt reassured. But the next day, the co-parent said that she was backing out. And I think most people would realize that she'd obviously intended to back out all along. And it was only when the judge said she wouldn't allow backing out that my co-parent did back out.
So this is a good, maybe this is a good spot for me to ask a couple quick questions, because you sort of covered a number of things. If it's okay, I want to go back and maybe ask a couple more questions about some of the things you spoke about. They resonate with me. I know they resonate with other people who are in these situations. And so just briefly, I know you sort of said quite a number of things. But so it was after, you know, your overseas holiday, I think in 2023.
Yeah.
Is when you were so afraid that you didn't return to the UK with your child.
Yeah.
So what unfolded particularly on that trip that made you feel that staying away was the only way to keep both your child and yourself safe?
Well, a lot of it had happened before the holiday. During the holiday, she called. This is hard to believe. We were in Orlando. I wanted to take my child to Disney. She called on the same day the hotel security and the Orlando Police Department to do a welfare check on my child. So my child and I were coming back from breakfast, and the security guy was in our room. And I sort of said, oh, what's happening? And he said, oh, we've had a report. Do a welfare check. Obviously he saw we were fine, and I guess he communicated that back. But I was very worried. It upset my daughter. The police had been involved as well. And remember, this, she reported us to the police 17 times in England, at least 17 times. So this is very scary to see. I mean, you would think, well, okay, if you want a welfare check, why don't you just call one of those people? Why do you need to call the police and the hotel security? It's very, obviously, very upsetting, embarrassing, because for the rest of your stay, the security are, you know, you feel like you've done, or they think you've done something wrong, you know. And my child was, after that, every time the hotel, the other thing was she would ring the hotel room repeatedly and constantly, and that was off-putting to my daughter. She was, you know, every time the door would knock or the phone would go, she sort of jumpy, you know. I mean, she wasn't even five at this point, I think, or she's maybe just five. And prior to going to on the holiday, just prior, I'd been called a couple of times by my daughter's school. My daughter had been voicing some concerns about her mother, which I have in writing, writing a picture form from the school that my daughter had been asked to sort of draw and do markings and stuff. And she'd also, a couple of times she'd gone into the school. At this point, I was only seeing my daughter sort of once, 2 days a fortnight. But sort of after I hadn't seen her for sort of a week or 10 days, the school had noted that my daughter would come in and say something negative about me. And they would talk to her, and then they would talk to her later in the day, at which point everything was different. My daughter was hugely positive. And it was just, it was as if she was being coached. She'd come in the morning with a toy, a comfort toy, worried, voicing things about me. And then afterwards, she'd be saying that, she actually marked me. She said that she preferred being with me. And now the teacher, I had a long discussion with the teacher, and she was concerned, I was concerned. My daughter had ankle condition that the other parent wasn't treating, and it's quite a serious developmental thing, I think. The psychologist report that the court did covered all three of us. Now, they had said some things about my daughter, which I was very worried about, and I felt was contributed by the arrangements. And because if I go into it too much, people are going to say, well, you're just criticizing the other parent. And I don't really know what level to go into. I'd voice things from the beginning. I mean, it's very difficult without sounding critical. I perhaps just leave it, just say that the things the psychologist noted, I think, were down to the environment she was in. And what I can say is that that has all turned around now. You know, everything that development, I mean, actually social services and CAFCAS earlier on in the case had voiced concerns that there could be developmental issues because of the mother. Now, somehow the mother ended up with custody, because I would say because of the way things are in England. And that developmental concern was playing out, both psychologically and with the treatment of the ankles and the stuff that she was voicing to the school. And it was really the combination of all of that. We use an app called Talking Parents. We were ordered to by the court, and it was things she was saying just contributed to my and the obviously the incidents with the police in Orlando contributed to a level of fear that I became worried for my child. The trial in 2021, the judge said that the mother was trying to make contact as difficult as possible, if not end it altogether. And he found that her aim was to alienate. You know, I'd asked him to make a finding of emotional abuse based on the history, the 3-year history. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he said, I'm not going to say she financially abused you either. He said, she did, but that wasn't her aim. He said the aim was to alienate you from the child, and the emotional abuse and the financial abuse were byproducts.
Let me just say that it's unusual, in my opinion, to have a court acknowledge parental alienation.
Yeah.
But yet your judge did, correct?
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example just to show you what it's like in the U.S. in certain areas. I was in a 4-day appeal 2 weeks ago, and parental alienation has been found by multiple court-stipulated professionals that have years of experience in high-conflict cases and understand parental alienation. And over the course of 6 years, in my own case, my ex has been, parental alien. I have been found to be the target of parental alienation.
Yeah.
During this trial, it just so happened that a CPS investigator was a witness in this trial. And under oath, under questioning, the CPS agent could not give the court a definition of what parental alienation is.
Yeah.
This person has been negatively impacting my family court case for 6 years.
Yeah.
And this has been a known statement from multiple court professionals that, you know, my children are suffering from parental alienation. The interesting thing is, after this investigator was on the witness stand, basically the person who is in charge of CPS in the state of Minnesota, who also is supposed to be like one of the last safeguards for these types of issues to slip through the cracks. But when under cross-examination, she very well explained what parental alienation was. She knew that a parent is targeted, children are aligned against the targeted parent, and they can suffer essentially cognitive dissonance, and they can be controlled. Well, when asked, if she was the one who signed off on the quote unquote recommendations that came from this investigator from CPS, the person who ran CPS said she endorsed the findings. When I asked the head of CPS, are you aware that my case is built around the fact that every court stipulated professional who was a parental consultant found that I had been a target of parental alienation, and therefore that is the result of why my kids are behaving the way they are, my ex is behaving the way she is, yada yada yada. The person who ran CPS signed off on the original, you know, case, like I mentioned, she stated she didn't recall that my case had anything to do with parental alienation, which is absolute flabbergasting.
Yeah.
So it's like, I understand how, you know, the courts and how professionals and how prosecutors and how, you know, everyday witnesses will get up on the stand and they will either mislead the court or lie, or also in my case in the last 2 weeks, they withheld exculpatory evidence and they were caught. I mean, this just is like every parent's nightmare. And yet people who don't go through these family court systems don't understand exactly how terrible they are. So after you mediated your agreement with your co-parent in late 2023 to resolve things, I think you mentioned she agreed each time, like I think there's three times, but backed out each time. So if I'm just trying to, from an audience perspective, put this together, you at that time had your child, you did not return the child to the mother because the mother was having some issues, and the court was behind you, I think, at that time, or I'm a little confused. No. What was the process like?
No, the court was, because we had a change of judge for the final hearing in April 23, and the judge was not very good, in my opinion, and he obviously hadn't seen the trial either, importantly, and he didn't have a good grip on the case, I believe, and he gave the co-parent custody. Now, we went abroad in June 23. So this was some scheme by me, which the co-parent alleges, some premeditated scheme, you would have not returned then. I mean, I did. I hadn't reached a level of worry and fear at that stage. So the final hearing was April. I went abroad for about 4 or 5 days with my child in June. It was then we had an agreement to share the school summer holidays, which are 6 weeks in England. And so I had 3 weeks booked and I was allowed to go was it July or August? I think it was end of July, start of August, for 2 weeks to America. And so that was the time when I didn't return. So it wasn't. I think my co-parent probably thinks it was some knee-jerk reaction to the final hearing, but it clearly wasn't, because, you know, we'd been abroad before and come back. So that's the timeline. And then we started mediation in October 23, and she walked away in, I think it was January 24. And at that stage, she asked for me to be given a prison sentence for not returning.
Okay. So yeah. Now you're facing a jail sentence for not returning, even though you tried your darn well best to come up with amicable agreement. And I think you said it wasn't just one time. You had it like three times, yeah, and she kept rejecting it, even though you were in a position of being overseas. You had your child with you, and the mother, who I would believe would be desperate to see her child and had every opportunity to negotiate with you to come back, she just didn't. So I question the sincerity of her really wanting to see her child, because I'll tell you, I would, being alienated parent, and in my case, it's been over 6 years since I've seen one child or communicated, and over 3.5 with the other two. Yeah. And still continuing to go through the court. Yeah. If my ex came to me and said, "Hey, I want to mediate this now in good faith. You haven't seen the kids in a long time. I have to tell you, it would take an army to pull me away from mediation until we succeeded, because I miss my kids that much. Being a mother who walked away, who doesn't have her kids in her, custody. I don't understand what she was thinking. Can you maybe, and I'm sure that this is maybe not even a fair question, because I don't know even if you know what she was thinking, but if you had to guess, why would, if I presented that in the correct way, and correct me if I'm wrong, why did she, what is your opinion why she walked away?
It's very frightening. I am terrified of her. She'd obviously spent 5 years attacking me previously, and the judge obviously realized, he said that's because she doesn't want you to see the baby. So I'd gone through 5 years of that. But what it seems, we could have returned in November 23. There were 15th of November 23, I wrote a court statement saying, please could you lift the freeze on my bank account so I could pay for a lawyer to, I had a lawyer say to me, look, we can write this up into an order, because I was worried that the other parent would rip up the agreement, straight away from the base, previous 5 years. That's what I worried about. And the lawyer said, well, we can help you with this, but it's going to cost you £5,400 for us to do this and a barrister. And so I said to the court on the 15th of November, can you please let me have access to my bank accounts to pay for this? And obviously it was up to the mother as well. And the answer was no. So things dragged on a little bit, but we could have returned in November 23. Now, my podcast, a lot of people will realize that my podcast features parental alienation quite a lot, and I'm critical of it. And it's a terrible thing that a lot of us have gone through. And obviously, the court says that the mother did this to me. It's my last wish in the world to I'm getting a bit teary. I am not an alienator. Some people would say I am, because we've been away for 18 months. The time between November 23 and today is solely because the other parent walks away from a mediated agreement that we spent weeks on and that she agreed. I never want to withhold my baby. I want to have both parents. And I'm desperately sad at the way things are. I mean, my child has changed so much in 18 months. And she, you know, the mother hasn't seen this. And I'm very upset about this. I mean, it's got to the stage now where the mother doesn't even call the child. And that upsets me as well. People could, you know, harsh people could turn around and say, well, you can go back. But based on the 5 years previously and what's happened over the 18 months, it would be suicide to go back. You know, you've obviously hired this guy that you referred to before as well. I mean, my whole thing for the last six, nearly 7 years has been fear of her aggression and that the fact there's been no protection from the courts. And as part of the evaluation from the psychologist and the psychiatrist, they were given access to her medical notes and my medical notes. And her medical notes go back with historic rage and anger problems and many, many other issues way before I ever met her. It turns out that a mental health team visited the maternity ward. I wasn't told. I only ever knew there was something wrong after the birth, because she changed so much and became abusive. Up until the birth, everything was fine, but something happened that day. And really, ever since then, she's been getting more and more aggressive. Now, at each court hearing, and we've probably had about 15 court hearings in the last 18 months, and I've had to go alone to all but two of those because I've been blocked from my bank accounts. And I think that's against the European Court of Human Rights, Article 6. But I've said to the judge, you know, I'm trying, you know, I want both parents involved. I'm trying to find a safe way to come back. I've said, you know, that she's agreed this three times. I've said the court, you know, you could step in and write a protective order. You've got the evidence there of the judgments and everything, the case history. And I just want a safe path. But nobody will provide it. And all I can say, to go back to your question, so I've sort of given a lot of background, but all I can say is that what's happened over the last 18 months has amplified my fear. I was frightened since the birth, progressively. And then we had a period of a few months or a few weeks where we were in mediation, and we had some constructive discussions. But as I say, before the first mediation hearing, she froze my bank accounts and my house without knowing whether her own child had food, money for food and accommodation. We could have been on the streets. And then we came to a mediated agreement, and then she walked away from it to get me a jail sentence. And then she's gone after her daughters and my house, and she's hired this Irish guy who we may discuss, and many others. She went to the press. She broke the court order. There was a very limited publicity order, but she broke the terms of that, as did her solicitor, as did the media organizations involved, and they broadcast the case. Now, none of that tallies with a concerned parent who would like peace. It tallies with somebody who's targeting the other parent and doesn't mind if the child gets hurt in the meantime. For the 5 years before we went on holiday, she broke many, many court orders. And obviously we have the court judgment on the abuse. I never once asked the court to sanction her, give her jail, arrest her, make her do community service. Never once, because to me, an attack on the parent is an attack on the child. I wanted my child to have a healthy mother and a healthy father. And me asking them to jail the mother for a broken court order is not in alignment with peace, and it's not in my child's best interest. So I never did it.
And this was during the time she was withholding your child, correct?
Yes, yeah. Now, there were times where I was given limited contact as well in that 5 years. But yes, she did break the a couple of court orders withholding the child. Well, one of the court orders, yes, she withheld. She was supposed to bring the child to a contact center, and instead she took the child 3 hours away and moved. So that was one time. Another time, that was in 2019. Also in 2019, she made allegations I had abused my child, and so she broke contact for that reason. So yes, and I'd never once asked for anything to be done to her. So consequently, you know, conversely, you know, I said, look, I'd just like to mediate some safeguards, and we did. But in the midst of that, she got aggressive with the bank accounts. And then as soon as the judge said that the mediated agreement would stick if we both signed for it, she backed out. And then the month later, we were in the court for a committal hearing. And I said at that hearing, I said, look, I want to come back if it's safe. We've got an agreement. I said, if we can sign that today, I'll come back in a few weeks. You know, I've got to obviously unwind the accommodation and jobs here, but a few weeks. So I offered to come back in March 24. The committal hearing was February 24. And she said, no. And so I got a prison sentence for 1 year if I go back to England. And it's in a category B prison, which is for high-risk people. I suspect it won't be very nice. And I won't see my child for a year.
Okay, so stop right there. I think you've said a lot that are really important parts of this overall story. And if you don't mind, I want to go back and just ask you a couple questions, hopefully shine a little more light on one or two things you might have said, because the last thing that you just ended up with is sort of the cliffhanger, right? You've talked about all of these things that have happened over 5 years. You were being withheld from your child. You kept going back to court. And you eventually came to an agreement that allowed you parenting time with your child. You obviously were allowed to leave the country to go to, I think you mentioned, Florida.
Yeah, it was our third time abroad. We'd been away two other times.
Right. Right. So obviously you weren't deemed to be a dangerous father.
No. She'd made allegations at the beginning of the case, and so they had to do an investigation, social services and various people investigate. I mean, she said that she thought I'd torn my daughter's vagina at one point, and so a pediatrician did an exam, which is very upsetting that my daughter had to go through that, but the pediatrician found nothing. So she made many allegations, and the judge and social services picked that specific allegation out, being very concerning to them that she was doing that to stop me seeing. They thought that she was trying to get the authorities to say this father is a risk, he cannot see his daughter. And so that had been the case that she tried to create suspicion earlier in the case. But by 2023, there was no longer, I mean, she was making allegations. And as I say, I think she was coaching my daughter before she went to school, but there was the court was happy.
Right. So that's what I'm getting at is up until November or up until November 23, you had access to your child, even if your ex was making certain allegations. You never made any reciprocal allegations or anything like that. And I find that a lot of fathers don't do that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why. I for 7 years, I'm now kicking myself saying, you know, I should have gotten a restraining order. I should have gotten this or that, because it's clear if I did, I would have protected myself. I could have protected my kids maybe even a little better. But you were obviously, had a history of, you know, going out of you know, going abroad with your child, having vacations. That's the weird part of a lot of these cases. And that's why I say a lot of people don't understand what plight a man like yourself will go through, because they can't wrap their head around, well, wait a minute, the judge allowed you, or your ex allowed you to take your, you know, your minor child overseas three times. You would surely think that if you were a problem, all bloody hell would have broken loose the first time you attempted to wanted to take your child abroad. Would you not agree with that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why what people need to understand is, you know, anybody can lie in court. And, you know, I find that the person who has custody of the child and takes on a lawfare approach and filing false charges, false affidavits, false HROs, false whatever, you know, these are the people who are actually the alienators.
Yes.
And doing this classic alienation behavior to turn those children or child against the targeted parent. And I, you know, and again, some women are targeted. It's not just a, you know, alienation isn't, and quite frankly, I even hate that word, but I'll get into that in just a second and I'll ask your opinion on it. But, you know, women are targets of alienation just like men are. Unfortunately, I think the statistics, if they're believable, it just happens that men are targets of parental alienation quite a bit more often. I'll leave it at that. You know, when you were gone overseas the last time, and I know that you've mentioned this a couple times, and there you were you supposed to be gone for a certain period of time, say 2 weeks, or what was that agreement?
Yeah, I think it was 13 days.
13 days. And you've already been with your daughter through all these really traumatic, you know, experiences that, you know, no young child should ever have to go through. And that is a forensic examination. And that happened prior to you leaving the last time to go on holiday. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think this was, I think it was 2020. I think my daughter would have been around 2 when this allegation with a pediatrician involvement in the exam. So very young. Yes. Yeah.
Wow. You know, and that is very traumatic. And not only for the child, but obviously for the parent as well. And I want to let you know, it's interesting as you talk, your story isn't unlike many other stories out there. I think there's a thread that is, you know, intertwines and intersects all of our stories. And it seems to me like up until the last 18 months that the court was actually fairly, I would say, maybe, I don't know if friendly to your issue or not, but it certainly seems like they tried to be somewhat. How would you describe the court?
Yeah, I think it. We could say yes up until this new judge came on the scene.
Right.
He was very one-sided, I felt. Up until then, he was a circuit judge, so fairly senior. We had a circuit judge for the trial as well. He was good. Now, we'd had magistrates and district judges as well, and they're of varying quality, and most of them reasonable. But I felt he was he'd made his mind up for some reason very early on, I think.
And that you were just the bad guy. And
I don't know if he thought I was the bad guy. I think he just made up his mind. Again, what he said about the psychologist was odd. Oh, she's well known to the court. So what? You know, I mean, I know lots of people well known to me, but I wouldn't take what they said as the truth without, or especially when I'd seen that person cross-examined and she couldn't give any evidence to back up what she was saying. So I found his dismissal of that. I don't know what he thought of me, but I think he, I think he had decided what he was going to do earlier on. We had several hearings with him. I think he just was never going to give me custody. After the trial, I had a fairly experienced barrister at that stage because I mean, it took all my life savings. I never thought I'd be in court for 5 years. You know, we go in naively on day one, which was October 2019 for me, or October 2018, and to a solicitor's office. And you think, you know, you've been told how your country is and your legal system is. And you think, well, this is going to be very quick because they're going to see the truth. She's made some allegations. They're going to see, obviously, that's rubbish. And they're just going to let us have 50-50 custody. I mean, it just sounds ridiculous now. So that's what happened. One thing I will say is that we had some magistrates and, you know, obviously it went up district judges, circuit judges, high court judges. I always thought early in this case, I thought if only we could get this into the high court, this case, because they would be brilliant. And this would be, you keep thinking somebody at some stage is going to see that this is such a simple case. Now, a few of the judges lower down did. But obviously the judges come and go, magistrates come and go, but I didn't see anything in the high court judges to mark them out from the magistrates. I think a good judge is a good judge and they can be at any level. So that's just something I'll add.
Okay, that's part one. Thanks again to Brent for interviewing me. Please join us again next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.